So anyway, we're going to do a PowerPoint. I got this material is material that I've gleaned from Mr. Scott Ashley, and Mr. Ashley is the one who's provided the slides, and I thought this was quite effective, and I felt it would be beneficial to you as well. And the theme of the particular presentation is about being a disciple and the humility that's needed to be a disciple, something that we all need more of, I need more of, and you need more of in order that we can follow Christ the way that we should. So we're going to begin in Mark chapter 9. And in Mark chapter 9, this particular event that occurs here that Mark has recorded is something that takes place right after what's called the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration is when Christ and Moses and Elijah appear to the disciples James and John and Peter. So all three of them were there and saw this vision, and it was an important point that God was making to them, and we're not going to discuss that. That's just something that took place immediately before we get to the passages we're going to look at. And so we read Mark chapter 9, verse 14. It says, "When they came to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and experts in the law arguing with them." So Christ and the three disciples are returning to the 12, and they see this large crowd, and there's something going on that they can observe as they draw closer to the crowd. Chapter 9, verse 15, "When the whole crowd saw him, they were amazed and ran at once and greeted him. He asked them, 'What are you arguing about with them?' A member of the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that makes him mute.'" So this man has brought his son to Jesus and going to ask for healing, ask that Christ would heal him and free him from this evil spirit. "So then whenever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to cast it out, but they were not able to do so. He answered them, 'You unbelieving generation, how much longer must I be with you? How much longer must I endure you? Bring him to me.'" So Christ has been working with the disciples, and he's training them in order that they can deal with a situation like this. But they were not able to cast the demon out. And what Christ says here seems awfully harsh. He says, "Oh, faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." So it does sound quite harsh. But the question is, who is Christ speaking to here? Is he speaking to the disciples? Is he speaking to the man who brought his son? Because the man has come forward in faith to ask Christ to please heal his son. He has faith that Christ can heal him. And so who is he speaking to? His harsh words are for them. They're not for the man who's brought his son. "Answering the crowd, them, they have seen Jesus." A lot of these people have been traveling around Judea with Christ, and they've seen Christ heal multiple hundreds of people. So they know that Christ can heal, but they're this just there to a large extent for the spectacle of seeing Christ heal. The disciples have been there for many healings. So answering the crowd, them, they have seen Christ do these healings, and in spite of all of that miraculous proof that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, they still don't believe that that's who he is. They just see him as some individual who can do miraculous things. They still don't accept him enough to commit their lives to him and do what he says. And that's why he calls them an unbelieving generation. And then we go on here and we see him addressing the father of this boy who's possessed by this unclean spirit and is causing all of this trouble in the boy's life and the father's life. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood." It has often thrown him into fire or water to destroy him. But if you are able to do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Then Jesus said to him, if you are able, all things are possible for the one who believes. And that's true. All things are possible for the one who believes. And immediately the father of the boy cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. And really, for all of us, that's a good question to ask ourselves, do we believe, and to ask God for help with our belief, because sometimes we need God's help to have the faith that we need to accomplish the things that God wants us to accomplish. Going on with the story in verse 25, it says, Now when Jesus saw that a crowd was quickly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, Mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And it shrieked and threw him into terrible convulsions and came out. And the boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, He's dead. So the spirit came out of the boy, and the boy was just there on the ground and at peace. He was not being plagued by the spirit any longer, and people thought, well, he's dead. But Jesus gently took his hand and raised him to his feet, and he stood up. So Christ cast the spirit out, said, never come back, never bother this boy or his family again. And then we come to the big question here in verse 28, chapter 9, verse 28. Then after he went into the house, his disciples asked him privately, Why couldn't we cast it out? And Christ gives them the answer. He told them, This kind can come out only by prayer and fasting. So it's something that is difficult for us to deal with every spirit just through our power alone or our faith alone. There's something more that needs to be brought to bear on the problem. Now, what we realize from this is that not all demons are alike. Some are strong and more powerful, and it takes more fervent prayer and fasting to cast out such evil spirits. And that was what was the apostles were finding out, that we don't have the power in and of ourselves to take care of this. We need more of God's power to be able to drive out this evil spirit. And it's a lesson for all of us. There are things that we can't do. We may have faith, but we may not have everything that we need. And the only way that we can deal with such things is by going to God and asking Him to help us with it. And that's where humility is crucial. Not just to rely on ourselves, but to humble ourselves before God and ask for His mercy and intervention so that we can deal with such things as this and to be able to help take care of such a situation as this to heal someone. So we cannot overcome the demonic world except through humbling ourselves before God and asking for His help in dealing with it. None of us has that kind of power. But as we humble ourselves before God and ask for His mercy and intervention, then God will hear our prayer and God will help us in dealing with such a situation. And it's something to keep in mind that humility is crucial to our seeking God and to our being close to God. And as we seek God's help, we humble ourselves before Him, and God gives us the help and the strength that we need. So it's a lesson that we can all take to heart, that God is willing to help us, but we need to humble ourselves before Him at all times and walk humbly before Him. So Christ talks about the fact that we can, if we have the faith, then we can even move a mountain. And when you think about that, Christ would say things such as this, to move a mountain, and we think, well, what's he talking about? But Christ was speaking in the context of where he was, and he used the surroundings to make his point. So we come to a mountain. This is in Matthew. It talks about this mountain. He says, if you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, nothing will be impossible for you. So, however, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting. So It's like, you know, he's saying this is like moving a mountain, so how do you do that? And how does he make his point? Actually, he is referring to a mountain that was actually moved during construction. So you have Herod, who was engaged in a lot of different projects to build and to construct during his time as the king of Judea. And so he built what's this mountain, and on top of this mountain he placed his palace called the Herodium. And he did that by moving all this earth to this particular place. All this earth he removed into place, and then built his palace and fortress on top of this. So he had the this was a physical moving of a mountain. But he's pointing his disciples to this and telling them, look, see, this mountain was moved and a palace built on top of it. So if you have faith and you humble yourself before God, you can do the same thing. So, that's not just doing frivolous things. Well, I want this dirt to be moved so I can not have to do this with a shovel or do this with a construction tool. But that's not what he's talking about, just doing something frivolous. But he's talking about things that we face that are like a mountain that obstructs our ability to move forward. And as we humble ourselves before God and ask for God's intervention, then we can move these obstacles that sometimes get in our way. So Christ is using hyperbole about moving the mountain. He's exaggerating for effect to make that point. But he's making that point not just for the disciples, but he's making that point for you and me. Can we move mountains? Most assuredly we can. We can move the spiritual obstacles, which may be like a mountain, as we humble ourselves before God and walk before God, then things that seem to be immovable. You know, we run into things like bosses that aren't going to let us off for the Sabbath, or not going to allow us to go to the holy days, or something that we're facing as far as health or whatever that seems to be immovable. But God is telling us that as we walk before him in faith and we ask that he would intervene, then God most assuredly will. God has the might and the power to intervene in ways we can't imagine. Now, going on here, so to Mark chapter 9, verse 30. It says, they went out from there and passed through Galilee, but Jesus did not want anyone to know. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man will be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand this statement and were afraid to ask him. So Christ is telling his disciples, this is what's going to happen. We're going up to Jerusalem, and I am going to be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. And they're like, what is he talking about? They had no clue as to what he was talking about. So Christ is making this point to them. The disciples still don't get who Jesus was and what his ultimate destiny was. And Jesus Christ is under great pressure. And that's why he's moving around. He's not staying in one place any longer, because the authorities and people that are opposed to him are seeking to take his life. And he is to follow a certain course, so he continues moving around the area of Galilee, and then ultimately he's going to Judea. And he already knows that the authorities took out John the Baptist. They took him prisoner and eventually took his life. And he knows that his time, the time when he is going to have to die as the Savior of the world, is going to arrive. So he's seeking to stay under the radar, and he's traveling around from place to place. And all of this, you know this as a human being. You know that this is your ultimate destiny. And it is something that weighs on your mind, and it weighed on Christ's mind as well. Christ was a fully God, and he was fully man. But at that side of him that was a man, this weighed on him, knowing that he's going to have to die and what's involved in that. And although he was willing to do it because that was God's will, God's great purpose for him, and so he understood that. But still, it was something that weighed on him as his time drew near. Now, Matthew chapter 17, continuing on, Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. It says, after they arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax came to Peter and said, your teacher pays the double drachma tax, doesn't he? So he said, yes. When Peter came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. What do you think, Simon? From whom do earthly kings collect tolls or taxes? From their sons or their foreigners? And after he said, from foreigners, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. And what point is he making there? He's making a couple of different points. What Jesus Christ is saying here is that just as human kings don't tax their own children, so Jesus Christ, because he is the Son of God, would be exempt from the temple tax. He would be exempt from it. He would need to pay it because he is the Son of God, and that's the chief point that that the Gospels tell us. Verse 27, but so we don't offend them, go to the lake and throw out a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take that and give it to them for me and you. So there was a tax collected, and it was collected from all people living in Judea, and Christ tells Peter to go out and cast a hook into the lake and get a fish, and you'll find the money we need to pay the tax. So he's making this point with Peter to emphasize to him that even though we are members of the church, even though we are Christians, we are followers of Jesus Christ, that we need to pay our taxes. Peter needed to pay it, and he was making a point to Peter, telling him basically who he is. This is a miracle that takes place. It's a quiet miracle. There's no great fanfare, but he's making the point to Peter. Should we pay our taxes? Absolutely, we should. And what he's actually addressing here is the temple tax. And the temple tax is something that was established in Ezekiel chapter 30. And basically it said that all members of the house of Israel were to pay this tax for the upkeep of the temple. There was a tabernacle that came first, and they were to pay a certain tax every year because you had to keep up the tabernacle as it moved through the wilderness. Things wore out. You know, if you're walking through the wilderness for 40 years, you've got to put the tabernacle up, you've got to take the tabernacle down, you're traveling with it, you're there in rain and you're there in the heat, and all of that is going to cause the temple to wear out. So all of the different implements would wear out. This is all made of various cloths and skins, and they all do wear out. So how are you going to replace them? So you're going to need to replace them. You're going to need money to be able to do that. And this half shekel tax, which is mentioned here in verse 13, was collected from all of the males in the house of Israel from 20 on up. And they're to give this offering to collect this tax in order to keep everything up. So we see here is the tabernacle in the wilderness, and they collected the tax in order to keep everything up and running and to pay the expenses of the tabernacle. And this continued as you had the temple. The temple was a much bigger, more extensive building, and you still had to take care of it. And Christ is saying, you need to pay your tax in order to keep this thing up. For us as Christians today, we meet for the Feast of Tabernacles, and we don't give a half shekel, but we do give what we call a tithe of the tithe to be able to have the feast, to be able to pay for the building, to be able to take care of the various needs for the feast. So it's an example that we've used in order to collect the money for keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, we don't have morning and afternoon sacrifices. We don't have sacrifices on the holy day. We don't have oil and flour offerings. And we don't have to keep up all of these things like they did in ancient Israel, but we still have to maintain and continue the work of God. So as we walk before God, then we do give this offering. And this is a picture of the drachma, or the coin that was mentioned. And it was a coin that was collected for the temple. And so as is pointed out here, this was a miracle that took place, and God intervened to provide for that and to show Peter that we do collect taxes. So as this question came up in the church, do we pay our taxes? Yes, you do. And so we all pay our taxes. It may not be something we enjoy, but it is an example that was set for us to pay those taxes. So, that, and they did this, why? As it says here in verse 27, he says here, but so that we don't offend, you know, the sons of the household don't have to pay it. But so we don't offend, we go to the lake and throw out a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a 4-drachma coin, and take that and give it to them for me and you. So God provided for them in order to make the point that we do need to pay the taxes. And it's all a matter of, yes, we're not part of this, but we do pay our taxes. And to set an example to everybody in the community. It says in going on to Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 33, it says, then they came to Capernaum after Jesus was inside the house. He asked them, what were you discussing on the way? So this is a little further along in the story. And another thing that happens as Jesus and the disciples are traveling on the road. So he said, what were you discussing on the way? And it's interesting, the reaction of the disciples. So they were involved in a discussion, probably a heated discussion to some extent, and Christ asked them about it. And it's interesting, their reaction, verse 34, it says, but they were silent. Now, why were they silent? Because they were embarrassed to have to reveal what they were discussing. You know, it's like, so they didn't want to reveal it. For what had they been discussing? It says, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. I'm bigger than you. I'm better than you. I'm faster with you. And probably we've had situations occur with our children where they've been involved in some dispute and we intervene and say, what are you guys arguing about? And have you ever had the situation where they refuse to tell you? Yeah, they're not going to, well, nothing. When they kind of lower their heads and they're looking at the floor and they really don't want to tell you what they've been discussing because they're embarrassed. They know, boy, if we say anything, we're going to get in trouble. So they don't want to get in trouble. So, you know, these are supposedly adults, but they're acting like little kids. And at times, they were like little kids in some of the things that they got involved in. So Christ goes on to address the issue that they were discussing because he knew, but he wanted to ask them. Verse 35, and he sat down, and he called the 12 and said to them, if anyone wants to be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. So Christ asked them about this, and then he's going to answer them. And so he sits down. And the reason he sits down is because he's going to teach them and he's going to explain to something to them that's very important for them as his followers and eventually being leaders in the church. So he lays this out and it's a lesson about godly leadership. How should we as leaders in the church or Christians in the church conduct ourselves? How should we do that? A true leader from God's perspective is someone who is looking for opportunities to serve, not to opportunities to exalt themselves or I'm better than you or I'm going to be a greater leader than you. We don't get involved in those kinds of disputes. The word translated servant in most places in the New Testament is doulos, which means a slave. Paul called himself a slave of Jesus Christ. So did Peter. But in this particular case, the word is diakonos, which is someone who waits on tables or is an attendant, and somebody who serves others, someone who finds out what others need and gives it to them. And the important point here that Christ is going to be making is we all need to have that kind of a servant attitude. So rather than striving to be first, we strive to serve. And that's what God is looking for in his church. He's looking for people who are willing to humbly serve other people. And not just serve a few, but to serve all. So he's looking for that quality of character which is service-minded, and he's wanting that to be developed in his people. And that goes against human nature. I mean, Satan is the god of this world, and he is not about service at all. So he wants us to adopt his mindset, which is, I'm the best, I'm the greatest, I'm better than you, and to be superior to other people. And Christ is telling his disciples, yes, your carnal nature is manifesting itself in this way, but you don't want to be like that. You want to be servants. You don't want to be considered the greatest. It only matters if you are the greatest if God recognizes you. And if you are the greatest, then God will eventually recognize you. And you don't have to exalt yourself or promote yourself. That's not what God wants. Mark chapter 9, verse 33. So to set an example here, he says, he took a little child and had him stand among them, taking him in his arms. He said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but one, the one who sent me. And who is the one who sent Jesus? It was the Father. So he said, if you recognize one of these little ones, you're recognizing God the Father, and you're recognizing me, because you are seeking to be a servant. So he talks about this with this little child, and this was probably astounding to the disciples because little children had no status at all in the New Testament. None. That was worse than, you know, stay out of the way and keep quiet. It was worse than that. They had no status at all. And Christ is using this example to make a point to them, because they would all be amazed, why are you citing this little child as an example? He has no status, and yet this little child is the one that he's using to make his point with the disciples. So little children had zero status. They had zero status. So Jesus Christ is taking this little child and basically saying, you should welcome this child as though you were welcoming me. Treating him, this insignificant child, as you would treat me. And if you welcome me, you are welcoming my Father who sent me. So Jesus's point is pretty simple. And he's basically saying everyone matters to God. From God's point of view, everyone matters. The rich, the poor, the strong, the weak, men, women, children, adults, everyone matters to God. That's the point he's making. Because every last one of them has been created in God's image, and every one of them has the potential to be in the family of God. So you can't snub anybody. You can't prefer one individual or one group over another. They are all God's children and potentially a part of his family. And that's something that is a guiding principle and has always been a guiding principle for God and his servants. And it's a principle that we need to understand and live by. And that's crucial because it's going to be a basic element of the kingdom to come. So as we seek to be a servant to all, it's as though we are seeking to serve Jesus Christ. So, you know, from Jesus Christ's perspective and God's perspective, if we, you know, and I've seen this played out, and this was played out in a most dramatic way when we were visiting a particular church area for a wedding. So we went there for the wedding, and so we were introduced to the minister there. My wife and I were introduced. And so not that we were anything special, but he basically had no time for us. So no greeting, no welcome. Basically, we had no status. Okay, that's fine. We went on about our business. But then it was interesting later on when he found out that we were ministers working in the church, then he changed his tune. And he was more than excited to see us, which I thought, that's not exactly the way you want to be, because that's not right. You should welcome everybody and consider everybody as a potential member of of God's family. That's just a principle that we have to live by and is crucial to being prepared for God's kingdom. So he goes on to say here in Mark chapter 18, verse 4. He says, "Whoever humbles himself like this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So you humble yourself like the little child. "And whoever welcomes a child like this in my name welcomes me." So Matthew adds this interesting angle because children have certain qualities that are common to younger children that are, they're teachable, they're correctable, they're repentant, they haven't developed all the attitudes that adults have. And so they have qualities that God is emphasizing. And so we are to be humble as a little child. And that's crucial to our being ready for God's kingdom. And as you think about this, you see the disciples singled out, the ones who are going to go on and become apostles, they're singled out, and this was written about them. And as you look at ancient literature, nobody wrote like this. Nobody wrote about the fact that they didn't measure up or they failed miserably, which is exactly what the disciples were doing. You just leave that out. And it's interesting, as you look at the book of Mark, they think that the book of Mark was written reflecting Peter's experience. And Peter was one of these who was arguing on the road. And Peter passed this example along to Mark, who wrote it down. So Peter realized this was not what God wanted, and he accepted what Christ taught him, and he learned to walk in humility because Peter was not the most humble guy around. He was not humble. And, he was had to learn some lessons, and he did along the way. Some humiliating lessons, which have been recorded in the scriptures for us. But they're examples for all of us. And then we go on and we see an example here that is important for us, because in the past we have tended to think that we've said things like, we are the one and only true church. And we've kind of looked down on other groups because they weren't with us. And interestingly, this particular issue was addressed in Mark chapter 9. It was addressed and clarified for us. And basically, it's a good lesson for us. We don't judge other people. We don't judge them. Because, now, should we judge? Yes. but we don't judge in this particular way. Mark chapter 9, verse 38 says, John said to him, and this is the one who became the apostle, John, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." He's not with our group. What he's doing is good, but he's not with our group. So we told him to stop. But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, because no one who does a miracle in my name will be able soon afterward to say anything bad about me." So obviously they hadn't stopped and looked at what this individual who was casting out a demon was doing. This is really a miracle. So, and you don't recognize that? You're just worried about who he's affiliated with. He says in verse 40, "For whoever is against us is for us." Whoever is not against us, excuse me. "For whoever is not against us is for us. For I tell you the truth, whoever gives you a cup of water because you bear Christ's name will never lose his reward." So somebody may not be a part of our group, but they're doing what's right, encouraging what's right, trying to live what's right, and they may not be with our group. They don't attend with us. But why would we condemn them? Because to whom do they stand? They stand or fall before Christ, not to us. So if they're doing what's right and pursuing what's right, then why are we going to be against them? So we try to take the approach, you know, as Christ lays out here. It's a lesson for all of us. And it's, you know, we don't get the big head because we're in this group or that group. And unfortunately, we've followed that path back many years ago. He goes on to say in verse 42, he says, "If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a huge millstone tied around his neck and to be thrown into the sea." So again, we've seen that God is interested in all. And there are little ones that are in the church. They aren't babies, but spiritually, they're not fully mature. So for us to negatively impact somebody in some way is something that God takes very seriously, and we should as well. So if you cause somebody to fall or to leave or stop following God because of our poor example or whatever it may be, then God said, "These are little ones, and it would be better for you, if that's what you do, to have a millstone tied around your neck." And it says, and as you think about the millstone, just to help illustrate that, what you see in this picture are millstones. And they found all of these near the city of Capernaum. And all of them, they're different shapes and different sizes, but they're all millstones used for different purposes. And they are made from basalt, volcanic rock. There's an extinct volcano near the city of Capernaum. And so you have all of this basalt rock that came out of that volcano that they used to make these millstones. They also used it to make the houses and the different places around Capernaum, and so you'll see this basalt rock throughout that particular city, the ancient remains of it. And it's very hard, and it's quite effective as a millstone because you're going to be using it to grind up meal and other things. And so it's something that is, and you see here a larger millstone, and this one was used to crush olives. So you would roll it around there, and it's a huge stone and very weighty. So imagine somebody ties one of these millstones around your neck and throws you into the Sea of Galilee, which where they found these millstones was about 100 yards away. So if they throw you in the lake, you're going to the bottom of the lake. So that's what he said. If you offend one of these little ones, then you may as well have a millstone tied around your neck and thrown into the lake, because it's something God won't accept. And as you think about this, offending the little ones, it goes on to say here in verse 43, If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life crippled than to have two hands and go into hell to the unquenchable fire. If your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better to enter life lame than to have two feet and be thrown into hell. And the point here is not to literally do that. Christ is speaking with hyperbole, exaggeration for effect, in order to make a point. You need whatever area that you're sinning in that would offend one of these little ones, you need to get rid of that, and so that you don't offend. You want to be very careful about offending other members of the church, and you want to get rid of it and ask God for his help. Humble yourself before God and ask for his help in order to overcome whatever it is that may be offensive. Now, let's go on and we'll talk about, let's go to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18 to verse 10. Matthew 18, verse 10. And he again talks about the little ones. See that you do not disdain one of these ones, for I tell you, their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. And this particular verse is one that people use to talk about guardian angels. And we know that as we do the blessing of little children each year, we do ask God to watch over them and to place his angels about them and to protect our little children. I'm not sure there's one, we don't know whether there's one angel that's assigned to a particular child. We don't know that, how that assignment is made. But God does intervene to protect, and knowing little children and some of the things they get into, we definitely need God's protection. It says in verse 11, "For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. What do you think? If someone owns 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, will he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go look for the one that went astray?" And that's a basic principle of serving the church. If you have little children, if you have someone who does go astray, and then you need to go after them and seek to help them to come back to church and get on the right path. Like it says here in verse 13 of Matthew, it says, I tell you the truth, he will rejoice more over it than the other 99 that did not go astray. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that one of these little ones be lost. So you see that God is very interested in little children, very interested in the little ones in the church who may not be little children, but they are little in the sense that they're just beginning to walk in the faith. It says here, then he gets into something that we all have to face as individuals. We get into individuals who offend us or individuals who sin against us. Matthew chapter 18, verse 15. It says, if your brother sins, go and show him his fault. And when the two of you are alone, if he listens to you, you have regained your brother. So it's setting out a prescription of how you deal with people who sin against somebody that would sin against you. And it could be something that they've done to you. It could be something that you observed and what you should do about it. And this gives us a first step in how we should deal with it. What do you do? The goal as you deal with this with someone that they're doing something that you know is wrong, and you go to them and talk to them about it, your goal is to regain your brother. Your goal is to help them. Your goal is to help them to get back on the right path. And if you can speak with them and help them to understand where they're going astray, then they can get back on the path. And that's how we are all to be, walking humbly before God and asking that God would intervene to help them to get on the right path. It says in verse 16, but if he does not listen, take one or two others, so that at the testimony of two or three witnesses, every matter may be established. So if you go to them and they don't listen, and what do? You don't just let it go. You need to get somebody to go with you, and they go with you, and they help to observe what you're saying and what you've discussed with them, or they may have been offended as well, and they can help in gaining your brother. So your goal is to restore them, to help them. And then the third example is if he refuses to listen to them, then tell it to the church. So what does that mean? What does that mean for all of us? Does that mean that if we know of some sin that somebody's involved in, that we tell the whole church about it? So if you're doing something you shouldn't be doing and we tell the whole church about it, how's that going to go? Then everybody in the congregation knows, and that's not going to help the situation. So what you try to do is you try to deal with it at the lowest level possible and in a way that's not going to be offensive. Telling the whole church can't help but be offensive. And then every time they see that person, oh, you were doing such and such that you shouldn't have been doing. Sorry, that sin or whatever it is going to be associated with you. So you seek to handle this in a way that doesn't embarrass them. You don't let it go. That's not the solution, but you deal with it in the most private manner you can. For instance, as you think about ancient Israel, there's already a precedent set here with ancient Israel, a couple of precedents. One of them is if you had a dispute or something that you had to deal with in ancient Israel, where did you take it? You took it to the elders. That was the system that was already set up. For instance, there was the issue with Ruth and property and how is this all going to be resolved? So they took it, they found a solution, and they took it to the elders. That was the way it was done in Israel for quite a long time. So there's already a system in place. So you would deal with, when it talks about taking it to the church, you would deal with it in that way, taking it to the church and seeking to keep it as private as possible. So the church has a system set up of elders, and you take it to the elders, and then they hear the matter and make a decision. And there's another principle that is brought out here. It says as you bring this matter up, you don't just have one person involved. Because in ancient Israel, when you had a matter come up, what did you do? You couldn't. It mentions the subject of the death penalty. You could not accuse somebody of a crime where the death penalty would be imposed. One person couldn't do that. It says, out of the mouth of two or three witnesses. So then you take that matter to them and the witnesses, and that's how you would decide the matter. And so if one person comes and makes this grave charge against someone, well, there has to be more witnesses before you're going to condemn them. And it says here that in chapter 18, verse 18, it tells you about binding, and I tell you the truth, whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven, and whatever you release on earth will be released in heaven. So does that mean that we can change the Bible, we can change the scriptures, and we can start binding new things? That's not what it means at all. The scriptures have set the parameters, and we seek to live within the scriptures. And so if you look at a matter and you make a decision, then God is going to support that decision. Why? Because it is based upon the Bible. It's not something, well, you know, we want to change this or we want to change that. You can't do that. God has already laid down the parameters, and you seek to make decisions within the bounds of the scriptures. And that way, everything is done and it's in harmony with God and His word. You don't seek to bind new things. For instance, I don't think we have to do that scripture about stealing. I don't think you can do that. It says thou shalt not steal, and that's the way it is. And we seek to live by it and make decisions based upon that. So we want God's guidance and direction in order to rightly handle a situation. And we have a couple of more things we want to go through here. And this is, after this conversation, then Peter asked, well, how many times do I have to forgive someone? So this is something that we sometimes face because we've been offended or hurt in some way. How many times do I have to forgive that person? Once? Twice? So Peter answers his question, and he asked the question in chapter 18, verse 21. Lord, how many times must I forgive my brother who sins against me? So Peter was trying to be generous. As many as seven times. And what does Christ tell him? He says, not seven times, I tell you, but 77 times. Oops. So that's a lot more, and actually the number is much higher than that. So Christ is saying that we have to be forgiving in a much more extensive way and let things go. And then Christ gives a parable about two men who had huge debts. They had these huge debts, and they're going to settle accounts. So they're going to settle these accounts, and it's interesting how they do settle them. And when you look at one person here owes 10,000 talents, which is a vast amount of money. Basically, it's in the billions of dollars. And then the other guy, this guy who owes this huge amount, ask if that the judge would forgive him, forgive his debt, and Christ, and the judge does. So what does he do? He goes right out, and somebody owed him a small amount of money, and he demands that money. And Christ said, and what happens is the judge gets wind of it, and basically he said, you, I forgave, but you've not forgiven. So you're still going to have to pay that debt. And he does. And he's going to have to pay that debt because he was so harsh and unforgiving. And like it says, we have to be forgiving of others. And it's something that is hard for us at times, difficult for us, because when we've been hurt, we don't want to forgive. And the lesson is, God has forgiven us a mountain of debt. And he wants us to forgive as well. And so it's something that we have to learn to do in order that we can be more like God and ready for his kingdom. Now, the final thing that we're going to talk about today has to do with when Christ says, put your hand to the plow and don't look back. Now, as you think about that, we'll go and look at this here. And what's happening when it talks about this, it's talking about people being committed as disciples. And so this guy says, I'll follow you. And Christ goes on to dig into it more deeply and to really lay this out. In chapter 9, verse 61, it says, I will follow you, Lord, but first let me say goodbye to my family. And Jesus said to him, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. So as we've made a commitment, how serious is that commitment? And when Christ laid this out in chapter 9, verse 57, the people who were listening to him knew that he was referring to the Old Testament. So he was referring to the Old Testament, but what was he referring to? Well, he was referring to 1 Kings chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19, which is an incident that involves Elisha and Elijah. And let's go there. You have Elisha and Elijah and the situation that takes place. And what this is called is a remez. So as he's explaining this, they would all remember back to this example of Elijah and Elisha. So Elisha had 12 yoke of oxen, and he's out in the field using the oxen to prepare the ground. And he had 12 yoke of oxen. So each yoke of oxen would be two oxen. So he had 12 yoke, that's 24. And to have that many oxen and to have them in his possession indicated he was very wealthy. So he had lots of money to be able to afford the oxen, to be able to feed the oxen, and to use them in his field. And so he was out there and was using this, and Christ is referring back to this. And let's just read in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 19. So in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 19, it says, "So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him." So when he threw his mantle on him, which is a picture you'll see here, that's an indication that he's passing on his prophetic responsibility to Elisha. And then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you." So as you look at the story where Christ asked him to follow him, it's kind of similar. It has some similarities because he wants to say goodbye. And he said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" Verse 21. So Elisha turned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slaughtered them and boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. So he, as he's called to take on the responsibility that Elijah was laying on for him, he slaughtered the oxen, shared the food, and then he burned all of the oxen, the plows and everything, burned them and left them behind. So, and he didn't look back. And the example that Christ is referring to is that, you know, when we make a commitment to God, then we're going to be 100% committed. That we're, like Elisha did, we're going to burn all of the plows and everything going with them, and we're going to follow Christ. Elisha followed Elijah. We're to follow Christ and to be willing to go that to that extent and to follow God. So everything else becomes secondary. So that particular situation with Elijah and Elisha, this is where he puts the mantle on him. And then these are a couple of oxen that he was plowing with. And so he slaughtered the oxen. He burned the plows, and he moved on with a new life, and that's what we are to do as well. And that's a high price for us to pay, but it is the price that God wants us to pay in order that we can effectively follow him and be readied for the kingdom. So in the passages we've gone through, we've looked at a number of passages in the gospel, and we've seen multiple lessons about being a disciple. And the overriding lesson is for us to be successful as disciples is walking in humility. That was the overriding principle Christ lived by, was one of humility before God, doing what God asked him to do. And it is something that we are to follow as well. So we see that as you go through the scriptures, that they're filled with different things that are important for us to understand and apply in our lives. And that's where humility comes in, and God has asked us to do it. And it may be hard, but that's where we walk in faith and ask for God's guidance as we apply the principles in our lives. So hopefully you've learn some lessons here from the principles that Christ laid out, and that you'll be able to consider them and put them into effect in your life. So thanks, everybody, for your attention. Please enjoy the remainder of the Sabbath.